it's quite blunt. It leaps out at you. It kind of clobbers you over the head and says, here I am. I'm glowing red and pink and orange. You can't ignore me. I'm going to bathe you in this light, whether you like it or not.
Little Lulu for Kleenex tissues was on one of the signs, and Lulu would leap all over the sign. She'd leap from letter to letter, turning on the word Kleenex. A giant hand, rather menacing, would come in. This is all made of neon. Come in and pull the Kleenex out of the box, and it would be green or blue or yellow or pink. It was in four colors. And Lulu would leap onto the Kleenex and slide down, fully animated.
A favorite of mine, of course, is the Western Exterminator sign on the 101. You can see it from 3 miles away. Yellow neon rats scurried across the entire sign, and people would, of course, back up on the freeway and get into accidents because they'd stay to watch the rat get whacked at the end of the brouhaha.
The Americans haven't just got neon rats, they've got neon cats, hats, and bats, probably even neon gnats. They've got everything from neon cacti to neon crucifixes. There's a neon Mona Lisa in LA, where else? And in Las Vegas, there's even a neon graveyard. Neon's nocturnally splashed the American dream across the continent since it arrived here in the 1920s. And it may just have become an octogenarian, but after more comebacks than Sinatra, it's still bewitching the night skies, all the way from the City of Angels to the city that never sleeps. Like the movies, neon has had its X-rated moments, its B-movie era flickering above derelict motels on windswept interstates, but also its grand premieres and showstoppers. Now, in some ways, it's an unlikely star. It's a colourless, inert gas. But if you link it to a transformer and bombard it with electrons, it glows bright orange. Neon tubes can also be coloured with phosphorescent powders, and the metamorphosis of neon tubes into words or symbols is to this day done by hand. So it's pretty weird stuff, a handcrafted gas that alchemises the American landscape as soon as dusk falls.
Neon is magical. The light is extraordinary, and there's nothing else like it. And I think that's what makes neon so long-lasting here. If you look at how cities have illuminated themselves all over the world, neon is still a light that nobody else has anything else to replace it with. It's very much of a glowing light. The light is not emanating from any one particular spot, much like a light bulb does. Neon tube, the light is coming from everywhere on the tube itself. And so you get this wonderful halo, and consequently, any sort of sign, architectural lighting, any kind of artwork, or even just the most simple pizza sign in a window is going to have this wonderful glow. And ultimately, then, that color and light alters the whole form of everything around it. And there's this wonderful dichotomy of it feeling old-fashioned and at the same time feeling very modern.
I smelled Los Angeles before I got to it. It smelled stale and old, like a living room that's been closed for too long. The lights were wonderful. There ought to be a monument to the man who invented neon lights.
Raymond Chandler made neon synonymous with downtown America, but it's no more American than the Statue of Liberty. Neon is French. Parisian Georges Claude was the enfant terrible who first isolated it cheaply and used it in adverts. He first tried it out outside a barbershop, which caused a frisson all over Montmartre. His Cinzano ad was a coup de théâtre, and his pièce de résistance a blue and orange sign for the Paris Opera, producing the term couleur opéra. And then by chance, an American car dealer called Earl C. Anthony happened to visit Paris and see it. He then commissioned a tiny neon sign about 5 feet long to advertise his Packard car showroom, the first ever neon sign in the USA. And it was located on this very street corner in downtown LA until the 1970s when it mysteriously disappeared. Well, with me now outside the Packard site, outside the world's first museum of neon art, is neon historian Nathan Marsak. Nathan, you were telling me that LA has the highest vintage neon sign count in the world, so obviously Earl C's sign caught on pretty quickly.
He called it the Liquid Flame, and he got very excited about it, brought it over, and it stopped traffic, and his business boomed. And
stopped traffic?
Stopped traffic, absolutely. And neon signs to this day still can stop traffic. But the original neon sign, bless its heart, stuck around until the 1970s, and then, as happens all too often, disappeared. And so you'll see, if you look just over across the way here, you've got the reproduction. of the Packard sign. That was 1923, and in very short order, everyone decided it's what was going to happen, and Los Angeles became the hotbed of neon in America. One of the early signs was, of course, the famous Brown Derby, where another thing Los Angeles did was programmatic architecture, buildings as signs. Los Angeles has always been about signage, first and foremost. And the Brown Derby was a building shaped like a hat, and they, in 1924, were one of the first to put up a neon sign on the roof that said, "Eat in the Hat." And it was a sign shaped like the hat.
So the building was kind of serving the neon itself.
And the neon served the building, and the building served the neon, and it was a wonderful symbiotic relationship.
Extraordinary. So signs here are as much a sign of the city as the buildings themselves, if not more so.
Absolutely. It's the surface, and neon is very much about the surface.
But you could, I suppose, say in Oscar Wilde fashion that this neon surface is really a sign of the USA's inner depths and preoccupations, the soul of America. That's the theory held by Eric Linksfeiler, who runs Neon Cruises around L.A., 3-hour bus tours with a commentary on the quirky secrets behind the signage. The cruises take in the derelict signs of Skid Row, the vintage Art Deco clocks and lettering on grand Hollywood hotels, and neon snuffed out in World War II, now about to be rekindled as part of an urban renewal program.
With appropriate music in the background,
From
a restaurant. We're standing on a street corner looking at the former Belasco movie theater. This was a theater of stage and film, which was later turned into a church when it didn't make it. And just on the roof, just next to the roof, is a gigantic sign. It's taller than we are and longer than two car lengths. It says, "Prayer changes things," in neon. It's huge. Great cursive font. It's very biblical. And of course, just above that, in novial gold and white, surrounded by a burst of neon, is a cross. The sign, of course, does not work. The church has left. We can see that a lot of the letters might be a little bit broken or down, but that cross is still intact, and I'm sure could easily be turned back on and will glow again.
It's just wonderful to imagine the thought processes that went into that.
The sort of
person who thought of the idea. Obviously a trendy vicar of the day.
Must have been. Prayer changes things. And of course it's attached to a former movie theater, which sits next to the Mayan, originally a beautiful, beautiful movie theater, turned into a porno house, now a dance club.
You'll find that in the well-to-do areas of any city, most of the neon is gone because they found them to be tacky, they found them to be trashy, they found them to be old school. And that's one of the wonderful things about Los Angeles is because it hit the skids to such an extent. The sort of well-to-do areas were the first ones by the 1960s to become depressed economically. That's why all this great neon, no one had the money to tear it down. No one had the inclination, and we have them today to relight.
Well, on our left is a collection of three movie theaters. We see the Roxy blinking with incandescent bulbs. We also see the Cameo, it's incandescent and neon, and the Arcade, which is pure neon. They've really been forgotten. One of the things we want to do is to relight these. It's a flickering, gorgeous mess of neon.
Which is now dark.
It breaks my heart to see them dim. The owners of these theaters don't know what they have.
It's kind of neon ghost town here, isn't it, really?
Truly is.
You know, you can really read a city by virtue of its neon. Ute Indian communities out on Route 66, for example, you'll see big neon Indians. You'll see big neon Paul Bunyans. You see one of those and you think, well, that's around Montana, that's in Idaho. You'll see big neon pawn shop. You'll think, oh, that might be the south side of Chicago. You'll never see the same neon sign twice, whereas you will see the same backlit plastic sign 100 times over. And that's why I think people in the 1970s and 80s started to look back at these neon signs and decry the fact that they were disappearing. I think it has a lot to do with America looking toward its past, in effect. There's something terribly postmodern about the whole thing. There was nothing new happening. What was new was so shallow that people started to rediscover it through neon.
This is a glowing beacon visible for miles around. Parked where we are, there's the flaming tattoo shop. From here, we can see the neon, white neon skull of this tattoo art with a neon knife stuck in its head. The Hollywood Theater next to that, flashing and very delicately, elegantly, in its Art Deco style. And the Frolic Room. The Frolic Room is to die for. That thing is just a piece of candy to a neon buff. It dates to the 30s, it's original to the building, And just a few years ago, when this building was being refurbished, it was threatened with demolition because it was deemed inappropriate for the family audiences that were coming to view The Lion King. The F and the R for Frolic Room just stretch and reach in double yellow neon, beautiful Noviel gold. And behind that is a zigzag array of a variety of color, pink, green, blue, and just beneath, word cocktails in light blue. It's a piece of old Hollywood.
What's your reading of America? If you were from outer space and you landed here?
I'd go home.
So neon has a retro feel, but the more it's restored, the more Los Angeles is finding itself moving into the future.
It is a paradox, but it is quite true, and I have the feeling if Raymond Chandler were alive today, he would certainly agree with you.
The travails of neon started in Los Angeles, certainly picked up by New York very quickly for Times Square, which became one of the great neon centers of the world. And then it bled across America, especially, say, along Route 66 as it traveled across America. And certainly through the Southwest, there were neon...
kind of artery spreading the neon through.
Exactly. Big neon Indians, neon sombreros, 100 motel signs, diners, the whole thing.
Evening.
I almost drove right past.
I'm always forgetting to turn the sign on, but we do have a vacancy. 12, in fact. 12 cabins, 12 vacancies.
Last 2 days, I've been to so many motels, my eyes are bleary with neon, but you know, this is the first place it looks like it's hiding from the world.
We've come all the way out here to San Bernardino, along Route 66, to take a look at a favorite sign of mine, Queen's Fine Food, the giant neon queen, holding aloft what appears to be a big plate full of grub. She's about 40 feet.
So her legs will be about 2 stories high.
A queen to be reckoned with. And what I really love about this sign is the fact that this matriarch of all of San Bernardino has thigh-high leather go-go boots and this wonderful ermine-trimmed mini skirt.
Yeah, very, very camp, very, very loud, no irony at all, rather tasteless, but utterly fabulous.
Tasteless, really. But fabulous. I mean, yeah. We take the image of the queen, turn it on its ear, give her food, have her serving us, put her in leather go-go boots. I mean, the whole thing is just so 1962 and sort of mod at the same time. The neon blinks. You can see this sign from about 25 miles away.
So is neon a barometer of how America's been over the last century, or is it a barometer of how America has seen itself and projected itself?
The neon bespoke these shifting demographics, the class, the race, shifts of money, and the fact that people delighted in them in a very simple sort of way. They were common currency. They were common courtesy. It speaks of our culture now, actually, that there are people who are interested in neon, when, by and large, for many years, no one was.
I'd always loved looking at the neon signs in the landscape, and I loved the pictorial quality of them, the cowboys lassoing calves, the trucks with the wheels of light spinning. And I had grown up traveling across the country. I picked the motel based on which one had the best neon sign, and then I started drawing my own forms. And to take it into another area, you know, that are not liquor stores, that are not porno parlors, makes it something very, very different.
Lily Lakich, one of the pioneer artists who dared to move neon from the outside to the inside, from night to day, from signage to art. She says neon has a primal energy that hits the eye with astounding directness. Perhaps that's what attracted Hitler and Albert Speer to the notion of Nazi neon. Imagine if they'd gone ahead with it and neon had become associated not with the American dream, but with glaring red swastikas. But back to Lily, who's produced some radical reworkings of neon, from a 10-foot luminous tombstone to a haunting set of neon-lit Christian icons, inspired by her upbringing in the Serbian Orthodox Church.
All of the iconography done from the beginning of time always tried to make them glow. Well, with neon, the metaphor is real. I see it somewhat like alchemy, turning, you know, this very base material that has been so maligned and stigmatized into something so beautiful and something we artists tend to think is spiritual as well.
Lily has 150 phosphorescent colors to choose from, and they've got them all displayed in tubes here on the walls of Let There Be Neon in Manhattan. After LA, New York was neon's next spiritual home, and for 30 years, Let There Be Neon has been a kind of East Coast academy of neon signage and art. It's ridiculously bright in here. There's a huge horizontal blue eagle outlined above me, and silhouetted against a tubular color chart is artist Philip Hazard.
Interestingly enough, most neon signs are not neon signs, they are argon signs. neon really only creates just your pinks and oranges. So all the rest of your, quote, neon signs, being yellows, greens, whites, blues, are all argon. These dark blues here, the glass itself is a dark blue, has an argon gas in it, which is a blue gas. And so blue glass and blue gas, you get this very deep blue color. So I've got ultra blue, super turquoise, aquamarine. I've got an emerald green. I've got a light green, apple green. Now you get into your yellows here. I've got a gold, a lemon yellow, a pineapple, a traffic light yellow. I've got a cobalt glass that's actually pumped with a red gas that creates kind of a purple. And so you can begin to have a juxtaposition between gas and glass where you're then creating different colors based on the different gas that's within the tube. It covers the colors of the rainbow.
And at the end of the rainbow, a bender. Ed Stryper bends neon for a living by heating up the glass tubes, then twisting them into continuous shapes or words guided by templates drawn by designers on paper. He doesn't wear heatproof gloves, and he says he can spot his own and his friends' signs in the street, as they all have distinctive neon handwriting.
What's the secret, then, of being a good neon bender?
Practice, practice, practice.
Essentially, somebody has written this restrooms graphic here, and you're placing the tubes onto the writing itself.
Exactly. And then I can make what we call a double back bend here, which is going to take us out of the O into the other O next to it. And now I'll go into the crossfire here.
So pinpointing a particular point in the O there, the top of the O. Do you ever burn yourself?
Oh, all the time. You have to expect to get burnt and cut. It comes with the business. You can see it getting very plastic. Now I'll blow a little.
It's expanded back into a proper tube shape now from the kind of squashed.
Yes, and I lay it back on the pattern.
Yep, and we have half an O of a restroom.
The beauty of neon is that it's instant on and instant off. If you're doing a big animation, you start with drawings, but it's a complete concept because you're talking about an entire motion or movement. They're like film clips, and so you've got to somehow connect all that and then tell the story with the neon tubes.
They say the neon lights are bright on Broadway.
On Broadway.
They say there's always magic in the air.
Animation was New York's big contribution to neon history. It's done by switching a series of neon figures on and off in a sequence like the frames of a cartoon. And here on Broadway in Times Square, the Cathedral of Neon, it's almost midnight, but there are so many signs, it feels like daylight. This was once the backdrop for neon's wilderness years during the Second World War and in the 1970s when cheap plastic took over and neon was relegated to tawdry topless bars. But now it's back. Corporate America has appropriated the signage of sleaze, and Times Square is ablaze with ruby red, sapphire blue, emerald green, and phosphorescent mauve. A semiologist could almost read America here. And amid the carefully choreographed chaos of neon, a cacophony of new technologies, the NASDAQ index whizzing past on giant LEDs, and across the street there, a Calvin Klein model wearing the largest fiber optic underpants I've ever encountered. With me now is Mark Stever, the director of the National Sign Company and a Times Square regular.
Well, we've got everything here from neon to the new technologies, which are LED. If you look at some of the full-color video boards you see up there, that is not possible with incandescent lamp technology, but it is possible with LEDs.
What's it like for you as you stand here, though? Because you seem to be reading what's going on. I mean, we were walking along there before, and you were spotting some mistakes and things had gone wrong and missing lights and so on.
On the Bertelsmann building there, the D is out. This seems to be the place where everybody seems to try out something. Anything that can produce light can be used here. Let's take the Coke sign, for example. That Coke bottle is about 35 feet high. It's an enormous sign. What we have is a mixture of LEDs, neon, fiber optics, incandescent bulbs. It's quite a collage.
The world-famous glaring red Coke sign here has 2 miles of tubing with spinning neon blocks, giant ice cubes and bubbles, and it almost fizzes into a sort of flashing foam of sparks at the top. It's hugely complex and possibly the most intelligent sign on Earth. You can even phone it to see how it's doing.
Hello. The time is 11:14. Alert condition okay. The temperature is 67. Okay, replace batteries. Have a good day.
Thank you, missing you already.
To be really spectacular, a display has to have great size, visibility, animation, and some form of three-dimensionality. Something that just sits there won't do it.
Thomas Starr, the impresario behind the Coke sign and many others, and the so-called lamplighter of Broadway. She's the third-generation president of Artcraft Strauss, the family company responsible for most of the animated spectaculars of Times Square for 100 years. The giant kitten chasing wool across the rooftops, the camel cowboy who puffed real steam smoke rings across the New York skyline, and the neon waterfall that covered an entire block. In her neon history, Signs and Wonders, Tama Starr argues that neon signs tell us who we are and also document modern American history.
One of the reasons that Times Square grew the way it did was that it was surrounded by very low buildings. There was a great deal of construction underway in the 1920s because there was a great deal of money available. Then, during the Depression, they all ran out of money. So they topped off their buildings right where they were. So this particular neighborhood had 2, 3, and 4-story buildings, which nonetheless had very large foundations.
So very stable for very heavy neon displays.
Yes, and my grandfather, Jake, went around to these landlords who had a fallow asset, namely a building roof, and offered them cash for leases.
So over the years, has it changed in terms of its accents and the feel of the place?
Very much so, and it's always been like America's town square. The Wrigley's ad from the Depression showed the little Wrigley man in a little boat floating peacefully in a sea of fish, as though, remain calm and the Depression will pass and you will cheer up and everybody will be happy together. Unlike the Wrigley's ad from World War I, which was very martial. It was a block wide, and it had these little spearmen stomping up and down. It's always been a reflection of our commercial obsessions.
It seems like in Times Square here, they pull out all the stops. And in Times Square, there's no maximum square requirements. There's more like minimum requirements. There has to be a minimum amount of square footage of signs, minimum amount of light. And right now, a couple strokes of neon are out. Got to get onto that one. Minimum amount of animation in order to pass the final requirement. So, you know, if you want to do something different, like a rebel, let's call it a sign rebel. Let's go to Times Square and do something different, right?
So this is the opposite,
let loose.
The absolute opposite of the UK, where we would have a maximum.
Take away all puffiness, and now we got Times Square.
The great spectaculars of the 1950s, a great boom time in Times Square, really played a part in the American image. Budweiser had the famous Flying A and Eagle, a recreation of their famous logo, which is an A with an eagle in front of it. But in order to make the eagle fly over Times Square, my father, Mel, rented an eagle, set it loose in the armory. This was before you could get nature films of close-ups of eagles. This is, you have to get your own eagle. So he set it loose in the armory, and there was a trainer, and photographed it in 8mm film. They took the film and gave it to a Disney animator, whose name was Bunny Rabbit, I still remember this, who broke the eagle's motion down into 8 steps. So as the eagle's wings went up, the feathers went down, and when the wings came down, the feathers went up, and the eagle's eyes blinked open and closed, and its talons stretched and contracted. This eagle was incredibly lifelike. And there it was, 75 feet wide, that's like a 7-story building, soaring over the Brill Building in Times Square.
Now the eagle has landed, or rather been dismantled, and the charming neon spectaculars have been replaced by an insane corporate freak show of LEDs, fiber optics, and TV screens. But the exclusively neon spectacular has found a new home, indoors, in the theatres of Broadway and the studios of Hollywood. Artist Kenny Greenberg produces animated neon for film and theater and says its meaning is still evolving in the 21st century.
Neon has this interesting multiple personality. Recently, I've done work for Men in Black and Men in Black 2, and neon has this suggestion of futuristic lines. It's used on the deck of the Starship Enterprise, for example. On the other hand, neon now has been around so long that it also can suggest the past. One of the interesting things that started happening in the Broadway productions, which was mind-blowing to me, was there have been scenes with Neon that people applaud. The Neon became a performer, which is the first time I saw that was in The Who's Tommy. The Neon was really quite subtle until its moment, which was for Pinball Wizard, where unbeknownst to the audience, the entire stage, including up onto the ceiling and out into part of the audience, was neon everywhere, so that the stage became part of this giant pinball machine. Oh, and when that came on, people just went nuts.
And it could be instant, can't it, as well?
Oh, yeah, yes. And it was just flying and all over the place. Neon can fit virtually in any shape and any situation.
Any shape or situation, neon is America's illuminated manuscript. It reflects every nuance of recent history. The shifting moods of neon map the optimism of the 20s, the depression of the 30s, the Hollywood escapism of the 40s, 50s consumerism, 60s hippiness, 70s sleaze, 90s corporatization. And now, as Americans reassess and reassert their identity, the paradoxical newness and nostalgia of neon continue to cast a nocturnal spell over the skyline of the USA.
There's a chain of restaurants called Buca di Beppo. They'll fool even the best neon guy. They've got a neon animated wine bottle, and it drips the droplets down into the glass, and there are people who will look at this and say, wow, look at that wonderful sign. It looks like 1952. And of course, it's only 5 years old. They've gone out of their way to make a 1950s style sign because they realize that nostalgia sells.
As far as neon itself is concerned, or more accurately, the technology of lighting by using gas and high voltage is probably only at its beginning. When you think that the gas doesn't have to be confined to narrow tubes, but with today's plastics technologies can be sandwiched in between plates, and then the whole thing can be made to light up, or the whole thing can be made to be transparent, so that windows can be made that will become illumination sources. So technologically, neon represents the beginning of a kind of lighting that we've barely seen yet.
A man wandered into my shop one day and told me a story about arriving in Las Vegas at nighttime. And he said he pulled into town and there was this gigantic, huge city. And he was really excited about it, and then he went to sleep and woke up the next morning and the city was gone.